Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 429th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, as well as a professor at the University of Alberta.
And as with our previous podcast, if you listen to our previous podcast, we were talking with Barb Farrell, who is one of the sort of de-prescribing gurus out there. And we spent a lot of time talking about generalities around how to de-prescribe and so on, and the issues associated with de-prescribing. But we have her back now to talk about some more specific details. So welcome back, Barb. And maybe you could just give us a little bit of background on, you know, the deprescribing.org and Canadian Deprescribing Network.
Sure. So thanks again for having me. Deprescribing.org is our Briere Research Institute website in collaboration with Kara Tanbaum at the University of Montreal. We created the website to kind of house our research and practice tools that we were both developing separately in our research. And a couple of years or a year or so into our collaboration, just in sharing that information, we actually worked with a group of other people to develop the Canadian Deprescribing Network. So they have a separate website that you can link to from our deprescribing.org website. We figured the more websites there are, the more opportunities there are for people to access all of the materials that the different organizations are producing.
Cool. And I think you guys came to a very quick conclusion that guidelines specifically about in diabetes or for GI or GERD or whatever don't talk about or don't spend much time talking about deprescribing or stopping medications. So you guys decided to specifically develop guidelines for deprescribing, and maybe you could just describe how you guys came up with all that.
Yeah, so that was an idea that we had here at the Briere Research Institute in Ottawa back in 2012, and we had funding through the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care and the Ontario Pharmacy Evidence Network to start trying to develop deprescribing guidelines using rigorous methods. So working with people like Kevin Potty here in Ottawa, who's a member of the WHO grade working group, we developed a method for developing these rigorous guidelines. And then we used that method to develop our first three guidelines for proton pump inhibitors, benzodiazepine receptor agonists, and antipsychotics. And then subsequently, we got some additional funding through CIHR and the NHMRC in Australia to co-develop a couple of additional guidelines on antihyperglycemics and cholinesterase inhibitor amimantine.
Yeah, and the topics you guys decided, it wasn't just, oh, let's do this one. There was a bit of a process there as well.
Right. So we actually started in 2013, myself and Kevin Potty, Jamie Conklin, Lalitha Raman-Wilms, in conducting a Delphi survey across Canada with geriatric experts to try to find out what their priorities were for deprescribing guidelines. And we did three rounds, benzodiazepines, antipsychotics, and proton pump inhibitors were in the top five priorities.
Right, okay.
So we chose those particular topics to get started with.
So we're going to spend the rest of the time on the podcast specifically talking about issues within those guidelines, and we decided we'll quickly run through the one for proton pump inhibitors. So why don't you just lead us through that, Barb?
I did want to say first, before you get started, Barb, that these guidelines have been published in Canadian Family Physician, and they're freely accessible there for anyone who wants to find them. But also, they are some of the top read and cited articles in the journal in the last few years. So that really deserves recognition that these have had a profound impact on the people who have read them and consulted them. So just congratulations, Barb, on that. And that's really what triggered me. I was looking at the top 10 to do for a webinar for the National College, the top 10 articles in Canadian Family Physician. And it's very obvious the importance of these when you try and look at the number of reads. It's really clear right away that these are always in the kind of top five for the journal. So
that's really impressive. Good to know. I feel like someone should tell my boss.
Just send him a link to the podcast.
Yes.
And we'll put links to all of the guidelines in the show notes as well. So what are we, proton pump inhibitors?
So proton pump inhibitors. Yeah, we started with that one because it was a priority. It was a drug that commonly people were saying they couldn't find the indication for it, the reason why it was originally started, and it represented a really high cost item. So our guideline development team decided that the scope of the guideline itself would exclude those people who likely should continue taking the PPI. So chronic NSAID users, people with severe esophagitis, documented history of a bleeding ulcer, Barrett's esophagus, etc. And then we focused the deprescribing component on a systematic review that we did of deprescribing studies for PPIs. And that's where you see, if you take a look at the one page summary algorithm of the, I think, 7,000 word guideline, you'll actually find the specific indications for which you would consider deprescribing, including if you actually don't know if there is an indication.
Right.
And so then it goes on to recommend options for either decreasing to a lower dose or stopping the PPI and using it on demand, including some numbers needed to harm in terms of who might actually have recurrence of symptoms or rebound heartburn. We've got a monitoring plan both for verbal patients and also for nonverbal. For example, people in long-term care that might not be able to say that they have heartburn or reflux. And then recommendations around non-drug approaches and how to manage either rebound heartburn or occasional symptoms, and what to do if symptoms relapse. And then the one-page summaries or the algorithms have been probably the most popular tools from all of these guidelines. But if you look on the back page we have of that algorithm, we have examples of the different proton pump inhibitors that are available, the different sizes, so that people can easily see, well, what could I reduce the dose to? What's available to me? And that's the sort of really practical information that we found out from piloting the guidelines that practitioners were really looking for.
Yeah. And I was thinking the very first part you started where you said we sort of eliminated the people where proton pump inhibitors are pretty much obviously should be being used. And I think that sort of approach probably could be dealt with you know, many medications. Is the biggest problem with, you know, with people being on too many medications is we don't even know why you're on it. But if, you know, you're right, if you've person's had a severe GI bleed or, you know, on an NSAID or whatever, those are the things where let's just assume they're going to get a benefit from that. They may not be, mm-hmm. and the numbers may be pretty small, mm-hmm. but if you get rid of those, it whittles it down to a manageable approach. And I think that sounds like what you were doing with the proton pump inhibitors.
Right. And including a gastroenterologist on our guideline development team was really helpful to identify those exclusion criteria mm-hmm. from people who you wouldn't automatically try to deprescribe. And then, of course, in our review and endorsement process of the guideline development, we have the guidelines themselves reviewed by the Canadian Gastroenterological Society, and they actually endorsed the guidelines. Oh, great. So yeah. We made sure that we were on our guideline development team, including family physicians, pharmacists, increasingly we included nurses as we moved along. But then we also made sure we had that specialist viewpoint as well.
Yeah. And I know, Mike, you and I have talked about this in the past. You know, often one of the main reasons we want to stop medications is because they have the potential for harm. And now I know there are a number of people who've written about proton pump inhibitors and the harm, but, you know, the absolute benefit from a heartburn perspective, we're talking about numbers needed to treat of 2, which we have very few medications for mm-hmm. that. And if there are any harms, you know, we're talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, you know, the chance of getting C. difficile on a proton pump inhibitor in the community is in the order of there's a 1 in maybe even 10,000. So even though, in general, proton pump inhibitors are exceedingly well tolerated, but I think probably one of the main reasons was that you guys wrote the guideline was probably a cost basis and a frequency basis, you know, how many people are on them, without any indication other than one time, you know, they said, well, I burped crooked one time and I got put on a proton pump inhibitor. Mm-hmm. And so so I think, you know, I think it's really important to look at this class of medications, but it's a different concept than the potential drugs that can clearly cause harm, antipsychotics, benzos, and so on.
Yeah, this was an interesting one for me, and I congratulate you, Barb, because the inclination when you're writing something like a deprescribing guideline, and I'm not saying your group would do this, but many groups, when they come at it from that standpoint, they'll write a guideline and sprinkle in the references they need. But you actually went as far as to include, no, this is the chance that if you stop, this person will have recurrence, which I thought was very reasonable to include. And the number is not zero. There will be people mm-hmm. who will have a recurrence of symptoms, and whether that's caused in part because of withdrawal of the medicine or whether it's real baseline symptoms, hard to know all the time, but it is important to recognize that the discontinuation of this drug is not necessarily easy, because some patients will have symptoms and need to go back on it. And it's like James says, there's no, the evidence for harm for this product, it might be 1 in 1,000 for the community. And in hospital settings and long-term care, especially during outbreaks, much more risky, I would say. But a lot of the associations are just that. There's very little strong evidence to support harms per se of PPIs. Like, they've been linked to dementia and early death, but there's a heavy confounder effect there. But I think, Barb, you and I've spoken before that the issue is it's not just simply that, it's also the pill burden, the cost of these medicines, and are you actually getting any benefit from them?
Right. And so there's a few things I'll attack there. One is benefit for I don't mean to use the word attack.
No, you did. It's okay. But
I should be less aggressive.
No. Yeah. It's okay. I don't mind you doing that, because you're going after Mike. If it was me, I'd be hurt, yeah. But I don't care about Mike.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's okay. My therapist says I need encounters like this.
Yes.
Yes. Very good. Very good. Okay. So now I'm trying to remember what I was going to say. Yeah. You talked about the evidence around what would happen, you know, the fact that we presented evidence for what would happen if you stopped the drug. Right. That we were able to get from these deprescribing studies. We weren't able to get it for all the guidelines, but for this one we were. In terms of the evidence for side effects and risks, we did do a narrative, or sort of like, it's called a review of harms. So we actually looked at systematic reviews of harms data from PPIs, and we summarized that, and that is actually available through the Canadian Family Physician website as one of the appendices with the paper. Yeah, so you can actually go in and see the risks, the odds ratios and such. And granted, they are not significantly common, and it's difficult because they're associations. However, that is not to say that proton pump inhibitors never have side effects. I've had many patients in whom we have managed to resolve severe diarrheal symptoms by stopping
exactly.
their PPI.
Yeah, yeah. Good
We've
point.
Managed to stop domperidone by stopping their PPI. We've managed to stop Gravol by stopping their PPI. So I think it's really important to consider the possibility that drug, which may not be needed, could be causing a side
sure.
effect.
No, that's a great
right. And magnesium is another one. There's lots of things that these, yeah, to say they're absolutely free of side effects would be false, but yeah. they're often not as problematic as some of the other ones you'll get into. The biggest problem with them is right. the sheer numbers problem. It's kind of like, you know, as family doctors, we have to be careful about ordering MRIs and all that stuff. But really, one of our biggest culprits for money expense is the excessive lab testing. Mm-hmm. Even though those are kind of low ticket items, I see PPIs as the same thing. We're giving them out like candy.
Right. So, and we're giving them out for so long, you know, mm-hmm, where, yeah. you know, the guidelines will say, give this for 4 to 8 weeks. We give it for 10 years.
If you're lucky, we yeah. stop.
But that's pretty close to 4 to 8 weeks. Yeah.
It's so, a fuzzy gray area.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is very, yeah.
Area, those timelines. Yeah.
So, Barbara, I mean, you've written the guidelines, and I know you've seen probably many patients on these. How about two or three tips and suggestions about what people need to know about this?
Specifically for the proton pump
inhibitor? Yeah, just like what, yeah. Because, you know, as everybody knows, that we, you know, people who write guidelines will put it in. But sometimes there's always some other stuff that, you know, just never makes it into those guidelines about just, you know, ideas or thoughts about, you know, that might be of.
Well, I think the first most important tip is to do a good job of the history so that you can try to understand if there is an ongoing indication. Because if you stop a proton pump inhibitor in a patient who's on an NSAID or previously had a bleeding GI ulcer, you could cause a GI ulcer. So you have to be very careful about who you select. And I do think there's a little bit of excitement about using this guideline. Sometimes you see it's just applied indiscriminately to all patients on PPIs. That is not the intention.
No. And so let's say you've got a patient who, you know, you're really not sure that they need it. Like what is your approach? You obviously discuss with the patient, and are you, you know, do you cut the dose in half? Do you just completely stop it? What's your take?
There's not any evidence that one tapering approach is better than another, but it's likely easiest psychologically for the patient to reduce the dose gradually. So going from twice a day to once a day, or halving the dose.
Yeah.
I've never really seen people take it every other day, but I know some people who suggest that. Stopping it, but giving them a supply to use on demand if they need it. Recommending Gaviscon, Tums, et cetera, to manage rebound heartburn. Those are sort of typical approaches, but there's no one approach that's better than another.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I have, I don't know about you, Mike, I have spoken to a few patients who say, you know, I didn't know, and this is without my intervention, that I didn't know how often I needed it, but I got to the point where I stopped it, and I kept increasing the interval, and, you know, I take it every 3 days, and it seems to work for me that way.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's, you know, a PRN schedule or an on-demand schedule.
Yeah.
And a lot of the studies of deprescribing of PPIs have actually demonstrated that people simply take it less often or they just take it when they need it, which is perfectly fine.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly.
Yeah.
And is that my
one thing?
Go ahead.
Sorry. I've sometimes seen where people are doing an automatic substitution of a PPI to an H2 antagonist. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the way to go, because if they didn't need acid reduction in the first place, then they may not need acid reduction at all. Plus, H2 antagonists may have some anticholinergic effects, especially in the elderly with reduced renal function. So that's not a situation you want. And of course, we are not using ranitidine in Canada right now. So that's also problematic. So you want to be looking at, can the patient do well without the drug? Are there non-pharmacological dietary things, stopping caffeine, different things you can do to minimize risk of heartburn?
Yeah. And I agree. Yes. And the only reason that you'd want to go to that is that I can't even think of a reason why you'd want to go that route, other than I think it's probably just best to reduce the dose and see what happens rather than switching.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. Mike, any comments on that? I mean, you've had some experience with this.
Yeah, no. I think it's all worth a shot with patients, and I think the deprescribing guideline is excellent because it kind of lays out some of the groundwork for that, who to target, and you know, that gives us a chance of, it gives us the risk of recurrence and all those kind of things, and some options.
Right.
So.
And what
other ones do you have, Barb?
No, and I was just going to say, and it is important to realize that you can try as much as you want. You will not get everyone off these.
No.
No, and it's not the intention to get everybody
off. No, but even... But I was going to say, you know, people who have symptoms, people are getting benefit from these medications. So it's our job to figure that out.
Right, exactly. You want to find the people for whom it's actually effective.
Right, no, exactly. Okay, so that's the proton pump inhibitors guideline. What's the next one we want to talk about?
So the second one we developed was this benzodiazepine receptor antagonist guideline.
Mm-hmm.
And it we were really surprised because after 30 years of literature and people being told don't prescribe benzodiazepines to older people, you would think that that message would have sunk in. But in the survey that we did across the board, every single time benzodiazepines came up as the top drug class for which people wanted to have a deprescribing guideline.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we set out to do that, and the guideline development team initially ran into just a challenge around scope. And so our algorithm, our guideline, is really focused on people who are taking a benzodiazepine for primary insomnia, not for people who have unmanaged anxiety or depression or are taking it for alcohol withdrawal, for example. So this is not a guideline to deprescribe all benzodiazepines. It's how to deprescribe a benzodiazepine receptor agonist in patients taking them for insomnia.
Interesting. Yeah. So, and it sounds a little bit like the proton pump inhibitors is, you know, there's clear indications where you just probably don't want to, you know, play around with it. But when it's for things like in general insomnia, there's so many other things we can do. And that it's interesting. And I think one of the reasons why they're still so popular, and Mike, I know you'd agree with this, they are effective for things.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that you don't necessarily, you might still want to stop the benzodiazepine mm-hmm. under some of those other conditions, but that's probably more likely to be done in consultation with a psychologist or a psychiatrist right. or, you know, a bigger team than the primary care team.
Right.
The thing about these is and I know you're going to talk about this, Barb, a bit, but the challenge is that patients love them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I remember again in training, and this guy would spin the wheel of pharmacopoeia, and we were starting, this was for anxiety, but we were starting a benzodiazepine on someone. And as we were writing the duration of the prescription, the number of tabs, he said, remember that although you're going to put, and I think it was 30 days or something like that down, he said, remember that really the second you hand this patient, what you've written is infinity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because this patient is never going to want to come off these. And that's I remember that was a profound thing. I think we actually tore up that script because he said that to me. But these things are, patients do love them. So yeah, mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about the process of that, Barb.
Yeah, so in for this particular guideline, we spent a lot of time talking about how to engage patients for those very reasons. And that's why of all of these different guidelines, this particular one, if you look at the algorithm, starts with a box that says engage the patient in discussing potential risks, benefits, withdrawal plans, what they might expect, how long withdrawal symptoms might last, etc. It gives some recommendations around slow tapering. It gives an example of slow tapering. One of the interesting things is that there's been some criticism that the example we provided is too fast without people reading that it says, for example. So that's been kind of interesting to try to respond to people why we would have included this particular tapering.
So what did you guys say about that?
Yeah, we just said, for example, by 25% every 2 weeks, slower reductions near the end or drug-free days. So it was fairly generic, and there's lots of room to extend that.
Right.
And in the guideline itself, it talks about that. But in the summary algorithm, there's obviously not enough space to put all of those suggestions.
Yeah.
But yeah, essentially a gradual reduction. And we talk in the guideline itself about having the patient be an active participant and making the decision about how quickly to reduce the doses. On the back of the algorithm, we actually give the sizes, the strengths that are available for all of the benzodiazepines available in Canada, so that it's very easy for a prescriber to say, for this particular drug, say lorazepam, I know it comes in a 0.5, a 1 milligram, and a 2 milligram, because a lot of people don't know that it comes in a 0.5 milligram.
Right.
So that's helpful information when you're tapering. Then we give some recommendations around monitoring. And we, for 30 years, we've been hearing all these horrible things about benzodiazepine withdrawal symptoms. And that's where a lot of people have focused their worry. So what we actually started with in our monitoring box is, what are the expected benefits? This may improve alertness, cognition, daytime sedation, and reduce the risk of falls.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure.
So these are the positive things you're monitoring for. Then we talk about the withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah.
Then we talk about non-drug approaches to managing insomnia, and we provide links to some of the online cognitive behavioral therapy resources that are available. And in terms of management of insomnia or prevention of insomnia, we include both recommendations that might be useful in a primary care setting, but also recommendations that might be useful in an institutional setting, like a long-term care facility or a hospital. Basic things like pulling up the curtains during the daytime. And these were recommendations that were made by the long-term care staff in the homes where we piloted these guidelines.
No, that's great stuff. And I think, you know, going back to the, you know, how quickly do you taper, you know, there's no possible way in any guideline can you put in the proper tapering schedule for Mr. or Mrs. Jones. I mean,
right.
You know, it's you know, I recently looked at this in regards to some stuff I was doing for an editorial, and for instance, like with the SSRIs, and, you know, and how often do people go through withdrawal for that, and how do you taper those things? And I looked into it, and, you know, about 50% of people can just stop SSRIs and never have any problem. About 25% of people will get severe withdrawal. And so there is no way to say, given that sort of background, I'm sure it'd be very, very similar with the benzodiazepines. You can't say that it should be every 2 weeks or every week, or, you know, or whether it's half or not, but you're just giving sort of, here's an approach to start with. And then everything after that starting approach is based on feedback about what the clinician and the patient see is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say the same thing with benzodiazepines. I've had patients that have come back and said, oh, you know how last week you were saying my Ativan might cause falls? I stopped it on the weekend.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And like, we didn't do any tapering. They just stopped it. And then I've had other patients where it's taken a year. And then I've had patients, I remember this one lady who came and she was taking flurazepam and diazepam.
Nice.
And I said to her, this drug stays in your body. Both these drugs stay in your body for about 2 weeks after you take one. So you can't drive during that time period because it will increase your risk of a motor vehicle accident.
Yeah.
And so she stopped them both because she wanted to drive.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's so like I said, so, you know, in a guideline, you feel the necessity to give some an approach. And, you know, when we met a number of years ago to talk about the MedStopper, and we said, you know, let's give some guidance as to what we should be doing. And, you know, you can debate till the cows come home. Should you, you know, assess the dose every week or every 2 weeks? There's no answer to that. And there never will be an answer for that specific patient. But it's an approach to start. Mm-hmm. And like you said, some people just stop them and go, I didn't realize I could just stop them.
And I would say one thing that, you know, about your very first, the first box on that algorithm is the patient engagement. That's a very hard piece. I find that easier than the taper. But the I would say one of the things that I've learned over time is you might not win the first round. And you might not win the first five rounds.
Mm-hmm.
But I take advantage when things go a bit sideways to remind people that the most likely culprit of your recent fall was blank.
Yes.
And I've seen that work where I didn't need to engage any of that. I've seen it work with the first adverse event, like a first fall or something. And I've seen it take three hospital admissions before someone said, okay, maybe I'm willing to get off this because I hate going to hospital. Like and people might be thinking, why did you keep going after the first hospitalization? It is a battle. And sometimes patients can get scripts elsewhere. There's all sorts of things going on that make it very difficult. But I would say to keep document that well, that you've been trying, and and you don't have to write a paragraph, but just indicate that once again, discuss the risks of this agent and encourage patients to stop they did not mm-hmm. want to, or something like that, or refused yeah. to at this time. Yeah.
And we certainly recognize, and that's part of the reason why the scope is on people with for primary insomnia, is because there's a wide range of people taking these medications for a variety of different reasons. And some people might actually be better if they continue on the benzodiazepine. But for most older people who are only taking it for insomnia, let's get them off, because it's certainly the risk for harm is very high.
Yeah, and I think we have to be respectful of the fact that, Mike, you've mentioned this in previous podcasts, that, you know, what's worse, the benzo, or if you stop the benzo, going back to alcohol?
Alcohol or whatever. Like, I think some people too are, in the case of anxiety, and I know this was not part of your guideline, Barb, but in the case of anxiety, I've heard many people say, well, it's much safer to be on an antidepressant. And the literature is not consistent there. And I think exchanging one for the other isn't necessarily the best approach either.
Especially in terms of fall risk, because SSRIs also have a very high fall risk association with them.
And thanks for bringing that up, because I've kind of just screamed that from the rooftops, and yet we've often talked about how, you know, in conferences around care of the elderly, et cetera, that the use of SSRIs is strongly encouraged. And if I got up and I said, you know, your patient seems a little anxious, don't hesitate to throw a bit of oxazepam, diazepam their way. People would, I think I'd be slaughtered at that conference. But if I said, don't hesitate to throw some fluoxetine or paroxetine or something like that, I don't think anyone would bat an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're also risky. And it's this population. I think you'd agree, Barb. We've got to be careful when
with
we're
everything.
Prescribing. Yeah, exactly. And for things like sleep, when there's so many options, and also an unrealistic view of sleep. People mm-hmm. want, you know, people want throughout their entire life to go to bed, fall asleep in 2 minutes, and wake up completely refreshed 8 hours later. And it turns out that sleep doesn't actually work like that as often as we would like.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. You know, to tell you the truth, I've probably, given all of the potential changes that SSRIs can do to all these different neurotransmitters, I'd probably rather be on a benzo than an SSRI, depending on what the indication and so on and so forth. And I'm just saying that to suggest that I don't see SSRIs as being any, if maybe not even as safe as benzos, depending on doses and uses and all that sort of stuff. So no, I think those are very, very good points. So that's the benzos. So Barb, there's a couple of other guidelines, and one of them is the antipsychotics. So why don't you just run us through those a little bit?
Sure. So the target of the antipsychotic deprescribing guideline is on those people who are taking them for primary insomnia, as well as people with behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia that have been successfully treated or perhaps unsuccessfully treated for at least 3 months. And in those particular scenarios, we recommend deprescribing, which for the primary insomnia group, people are typically taking a very low dose. It can be simply stopped. We recommend more of a tapering, a monitoring, very slow tapering, a monitoring approach with the antipsychotic, particularly if the patients had severe symptoms to begin with. And again, we've recommended a monitoring plan in terms of both the positive effects of monitoring as well as the drug withdrawal effects, and then options to consider if there are relapses for BPSD, and then the same options for insomnia treatment as for the benzodiazepine guideline.
Now, Barb, I have to say, this one to me, we've talked about, you know, other drugs may have harms, and some of the data on harms is related to cohort studies and blah, 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 and observational data. This one to me is a little bit different. It's kind of a slam dunk. We have RCT level data of harms. We have RCT data that withdraw actually benefits patients and reduces mortality and all sorts of things. We know it's supported by the observational studies, but the RCT data and meta analysis of RCT data shows increased risk of cerebrovascular events and all sorts of things. And
right.
These are very commonly prescribed to control behavior, which they do very marginally at best. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then using for sleep, obviously, it's the same kind of thing. Is that the best approach? So I think this one is, a slam dunk, if you will, mm-hmm. about how there's probably very little is being gained from them, but there is considerable harms. And I think, you know, I've tried to, it's not that I've never prescribed these for, let's say, for agitation. It's not that I've never prescribed them, but the times when I do, when I talk to family about the risk of the medicines, their eyes absolutely light up when I say this may actually increase the risk of your dad or mom dying early. They mm-hmm. are shocked by that. And they should be. They should absolutely be shocked. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, we talk about other risks of adverse events when we give antibiotics. You might get some diarrhea. I think this deserves mention. And I wonder how many times people would accept it if they knew that that risk was there.
Right. Well, yeah, one of the things you brought up is the fact that you discussed this, the potential adverse effects with patients and their families. And that's one of the things we've tried to do in addition to these algorithms that summarize our guidelines, is to create patient and family information pamphlets that provide the same information in a more patient-friendly manner. So both of those knowledge mobilization tools, the algorithm and the patient pamphlet, contain the information about the side effects of antipsychotics, for example.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I think we actually haven't mentioned it much. I think it is exceedingly important to include family members in this, because they're going to wonder mm-hmm. why one is doing that. You know, are you just trying to get rid of the medications because you think, you know,
the biggest suggestion, James, is you're trying to save money.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And
you're you're stopping dad's medicines because you're trying to save money.
Exactly. And so, you know, you need to have that conversation, because, you know, if you don't have family support in doing this, it makes it much more difficult.
It's hard, yeah.
You know, and especially, you know, obviously, you know, in people who are on these medications who can't make decisions for themselves, obviously you're going to be involving the family. But even if they can make their own decisions, you know, these are often a family discussion. You know, like, we'll get into talking about other medications like the diabetes drugs. But, you know, family members need to be aware that maybe they don't need this anymore. And otherwise they're worried. But they've had diabetes all their, you know, and they've been suffering, which a term I hate associated with diabetes. The main suffering is the suffering we put them through with all the medications and everything else. But, you know, it's that sort of...
No, you're right.
It's so important that we include family members in this whenever possible.
Right. And when I said that their first reaction is, are you trying to save money? That's the negative. Many of them will also, know you as their care provider and think, well, obviously, you know, Dr. McCormick is doing this because he has the best intention of dad in mind, or doesn't think he needs it anymore. Mm-hmm. But some will jump to the negative. But exactly. Barb, mm-hmm. we did lead into what is the next one? I think it's the sugar medicines, correct?
Yes, the antihyperglycemics. So this particular one, what we were trying to do is address the issue of hypoglycemia in the elderly, which is one of the main reasons for hospital admission in the U.S. related to drugs. We've essentially got two recommendations here. One, and these are going to sound pretty obvious, but one is to individualize A1C and blood glucose targets for elderly people. This is consistent with the Canadian Diabetes Guidelines. We've included PATH guidelines from the group at Dalhousie and looking at end-of-life mm-hmm. care and care of people with dementia and extreme frailty. So it's really about individualizing those targets and then de-prescribing medications that are not required to achieve A1Cs, for example, less than 6%. And then the second component is to look specifically at hypoglycemia and reduce drugs such as sulfonylureas or insulin that are most likely contributing to hypoglycemia, or to potentially switch agents that are safer, and to look at the creatinine clearance and reduce doses of renally eliminated antihyperglycemics. So it's got a specific recommendations around the drugs how to monitor. It's got a table on the back that talks about which drugs are most likely to cause hypoglycemia, information about engaging patients and caregivers, what you can tell them about why you're doing this, and why goals of care change as people age with diabetes, and some information also about the risks of hypoglycemia. And we've also included some information about other drugs that affect glycemic control.
No, great stuff. And you know, the you said that the glycemic numbers change as you get older. I would suggest they change as the people who write the guidelines decide to write them. Because I think, because you can, you know, even just in the last year and a half, I mean, the American College of Physicians came out with a guideline saying, you know, an A1C between 7 and 8 for most patients is pretty good. And then, you know, the endocrinology group said, well, no, you really should be getting people to less than 6.5. So literally you can find a guideline that will support whatever, almost whatever A1C that you recommend. And I know, you know, when if you look at, you know, there's a diabetes care program of Nova Scotia, and we've had people on the podcast to talk about that before that. And, you know, especially, you know, in the severely frail individuals, they're saying, your target for an A1C is any, you know, anything below 12% is good.
Yeah. You know? And then, well, it's, mm-hmm. and it's also the random sugars that they were talking exactly. about a lot in there, and how,
right.
yeah, like we're way too aggressive. And I think this is for the exact reason you mentioned, Barb. We talk a lot about things like the Beers criteria and things like that, but what we should be looking at is what's driving people into hospital and having bad events. And when you look at that kind of evidence, the hyperglycemics are not, they don't have a great track record.
Right.
And we need to be, and there's a lot of lip service given to individualizing targets within guidelines. But when you actually actualize that in practice, you will see that many people are still far too aggressive in our elderly patients. And so this is,
right.
once again, a great reminder to don't worry so much about it. The harms of hypoglycemia are real and important to patients. And that's exactly what that study found about mm-hmm. driving people into hospital was these very drugs was one of the top two.
Right. And one of the things you talked about studies that have shown what people think about hypoglycemia. And one of the things we did for each of these guidelines was a literature review on patient and family values and preferences around treatment of the condition, or if we could find it around deprescribing of the medication. So we tried to incorporate that as we developed each of the guidelines as well.
And I was going to add in, I mean, one of the biggest culprits, I mean, there's you know, the sulfonylureas and so on, but insulin is one of the biggest ones because it works so effectively. Yeah. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, there are a number, one, I don't know if people would, hopefully people would be interested. There's not a single study, and there's about two that have been done. There's not a single study that shows that giving insulin reduces the long-term complications of issues in type 2 diabetes. And certainly we don't have that in people over the age of 70 and 75 and so on. And there was a recent study that looked at, you know, how, if not just maybe stopping insulin, just simplifying it and just giving, you know, you know, just giving a single, you know, a single dose of insulin once a day. And they did this review, and they showed that you could get basically similar glucose control, and then cut the duration or the amount of hypoglycemia by 2/3. So, mm-hmm. you know, in general, I think we way overuse insulin, but we way overuse it because we're trying to get to these targets, and sometimes the only way to get to those targets is we got to give lots of medications. And so, I think insulin's one of the biggest players here. And this, and I know you know this, Barb, and I'm sure Mike is, when people get sick and we don't do something to those medications where they stop eating, that's where the problems right. really happen.
Right. Right.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think, you know, that, I think the, you know, the antipsychotics are, as Mike said, that's a no brainer. We need to be going after this. The antihyperglycemics, especially the things like the sulfonylureas, especially if you are on those and, you know, you have very poor renal function, but insulin is a biggie. And I think we need to really put an emphasis on that. And I'm sure I'm sure you'd agree, Barb.
Yeah. And I think before you get to the decisions about the deprescribing of the antihyperglycemics, everybody, including the patient, the family doctor, the endocrinologist, everyone needs to be on board with what are the appropriate targets for this patient at this time. Mm-hmm. And how is that going to change in 6 months or a year? How are we going to reevaluate it to make sure that we are aiming for the most appropriate targets while minimizing harm for this patient?
Yeah. Now, for sure, you know, if a person regularly has symptoms associated with, you know, high glucose, they're thirsty all the time and,
right,
you know, and peeing all the time, that's a different story.
So you need to understand that. What are the levels at which this patient begins to develop problems?
Yeah, yeah.
You need to know that.
And I think it's really important to just realize that, you know, a few months of your A1C being at 9 is not, you know, a death certificate. You know, you know, there's not a big difference in overall risk between a 9 and an 8 and a 7. These are subtle numbers. And if people appreciated that, then I think they'd be more willing to back off versus going, oh, we've got to treat your diabetes type of thing. So, I mean, we've probably spent 100 of our 400 and some odd podcasts talking about these issues.
This very topic, yeah.
And yet it still continues.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard it all before.
Yeah, exactly. So this has been great, Barb. I really want to applaud you and your team and everyone involved with this. This is such useful work, and it's very practical work because you guys live and breathe this every day. And I just wish some of this would go into the other guidelines as well. I think it's really needed just to have a deprescribing guideline, but boy, it would be nice.
That's actually my long-term secret plan.
Yes.
All guidelines include deprescribing sections.
Yeah, well, I wish you the best of luck. And I totally agree. It's fascinating why that does not happen. I don't know why. It seems like it should be.
I think I'm an optimist, and I think it's coming.
Yeah.
And more people are definitely talking about it, and I think it could happen in the future.
Yeah. Oh no, I think it will. I don't know if it'll be in our future, but.
I think it's going to be irresponsible not to do that.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. So. Yeah. So, like I said, well done with all this, and you did a great job on the podcast, and I'm sure there's a lot of nice tips and suggestions. But one of the most important things is you want to drive people towards these guidelines because they've got so much value in them. Mike, anything else you want to add?
Nope, I think that was an awesome review of those areas.
Yeah, no, excellent. Awesome. So I think why don't we just leave it at that? So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.